Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. If you are new listeners, you should know that we have a new program for you twice a week on Thursdays and Sundays, and that all our programs going back to a year are available for free 24/7 worldwide at our website redicecreations.com. If you like what we do here and want more, you need to check out our members section with extended interviews with many of our guests, exclusively available for subscribers to Red Ice Creations. We also have our short film production available in our member section. The first part, Longevity and the Grail, is up there right now, available in high-resolution flash format for streaming or download. You will find all information on how you can sign up with us and get full access to our member section on redicecreations.com. Click on subscribe. I'm glad you're here today and tuned in. You are in for an excellent program. We have Joseph P. Farrell with us. Back in April this year, we had Joseph with us talking about his book SS Brotherhood of the Bell and the Giza Death Star trilogy. Joseph has a brand new book out called The Cosmic War, Interplanetary Warfare, Modern Physics and Ancient Texts. And I want to read a blurb from Joseph's new book. Rejecting the naturalist and materialist assumptions of catastrophism from Velikovsky to Alford, Farrell says that it's time to take the ancient myths of cosmic war in the heavens seriously. Arguing his case from extraterrestrial artifacts, cutting-edge ideas in contemporary physics, and texts of ancient myths, Farrell maintains that an ancient interplanetary war was fought in our own solar system with weapons of extraordinary power and sophistication. In doing so, he offers a solution to an enigma that has mystified researchers, disclosing the real nature of the secret technology behind the ancient tablets of destinies, one of the causes of the ancient war, and the means by which it was waged. Interesting indeed. It's going to be awesome to talk more about this here today. Good to have you back on the program. Thank you for coming on again, Joseph.
Thank you for having me on, Henrik. It's a pleasure.
So, a new book out. I remember we talked briefly about this last time you were on. The Cosmic War, or Interplanetary Warfare. I want to begin, you know, right there, basically. Define for us, if you will, what you mean by a cosmic war or an interplanetary warfare.
Well, one of the things I do in the book is it kind of combines Dr. Tom Van Flandern's exploded planet hypothesis with an examination of ancient texts. And for listeners who don't know Dr. Tom Van Flandern, he was an astronomer with the U.S. Naval Observatory for many years here in the United States. And he came gradually to reject the standard astronomical theory for the origin of comets in the Oort cloud, supposed Oort cloud, that exists beyond the orbit of Pluto. And essentially what he concluded was that the asteroid belt shows all the signs of having been the remnants of an exploded planet. And in doing this, he kind of revives an astronomical theory that was quite popular in the early 19th century, and he fleshes it out a bit more by examining the geological evidence of asteroids and so on and so forth, and running a statistical computation of the origin of comets. And he discovered that if you do that, the orbits of various comets that he plots in his calculations show that this planet would have exploded at certain points in history. And he comes up with the dates of about 65 million years ago and then approximately 3.2 million years ago. And I thought that was very interesting, because if we go back and look at some of the ancient Sumerian texts or Vedic texts in the Hindu tradition, those dates also pop out as being dates where a significant catastrophe happened. So I began to question the the mechanism that Dr. Van Flandern proposes, actually he proposes several in his hypothesis,
mm-hmm.
about why this planet would have exploded. And he comes up basically, if you read him very carefully, with three different mechanisms, and one of them is, after he explores the others, and I think he himself is kind of uncomfortable with them, because there really isn't a good physics model for why a planet should just suddenly and spontaneously blow up. So one of the final things that he proposes, and he kind of leaves it hanging in the air, he doesn't even explore it any further, he just mentions deliberate action, or in other words, a war. So that really set me on the path of examining some of the ancient Sumerian and Egyptian texts, because of course they're full of all of these references to wars of the gods and the technologies by which they were fought. And to get finally to your answer here, to your question, one of the things I conclude on the basis of certain evidence is that this war probably involved civilizations, or a civilization that existed on this planet, on the moon, on Mars, on the now missing planet, and then certain satellites of Saturn.
Wow, fascinating.
It was right here in our local celestial neighborhood.
Wow. So 65 million years ago, or 3.2 million years ago?
Right. This is something that later led him to modify his hypothesis, because in his first version, the statistical computation that he used to plot out the orbits of comets and run them backwards, so to speak, they all fell out more conveniently at the 3.2 million years date. And of course, he began looking for evidence on Earth, geological evidence on Earth, that would support some sort of sudden catastrophic inundation of the planet by debris from that explosion. And he found it, but the trouble was that it occurred at the so-called KT boundary layer in geological history, and that boundary layer just so happens to be a layer of kind of carbonaceous material that occurs at 65 million years ago. So he was led to revise his hypothesis rather extensively, in fact, by proposing two explosions. So in other words, the geological evidence and the astronomical evidence came into conflict at a certain point, and he was led on that basis to modify his hypothesis in favor of the geological evidence. And in doing so, he discovered that there were actually two different classes of asteroids that seemed to support the idea that they had originated from different planets that had shared that common orbit in the asteroid belt. But again, you know, this kind of points out the problem with the exploded planet hypothesis, because now instead of one planet suddenly and spontaneously exploding, we have two, and there's really no real good physics model for why a planet should suddenly and spontaneously explode. So, if we take the exploded planet hypothesis and then compare it to some of these ancient Sumerian and Egyptian myths, the war hypothesis stands out very clearly in those texts. So, you know, what I'm basically saying is that we need to examine that idea very seriously and see if there's any supporting physics for it.
Very interesting. 3.2 million years ago, that's, you know, a bit less than 65 million years ago, but still, that's a long time ago.
That's right.
You know, do you think that there were humans around at that time?
Well, this is the other bit of corroborating evidence that we have to look at. One of the interesting things that's been going on in this country, I don't know if this controversy has reached Europe or not, but a couple of American archaeologists that are very familiar with the Vedic Hindu tradition were led to write a book called Forbidden Archaeology. It's a massive 900 plus page tome.
Oh, yeah.
In which they examine some archaeological evidence that has more or less either been forgotten or just simply suppressed of anomalous artifacts that are clearly the workmanship of some sort of intelligence that occur in geological strata that are way, way earlier than the standard history would allow mankind to exist on Earth. But the point is, in doing this examination, they basically make a case that somebody of intelligence existed here millions of years ago. If it wasn't man, then it was somebody else, perhaps a precursor sort of human-like race, or perhaps some sort of extraterrestrial human-like race. We don't really know. But the clear evidence is there that somebody had to have been here in order for these artifacts to exist. One of the most famous examples that I recall them citing is a case of some very strangely machined, almost rectangular metal tubes that were found in France in a geological and archaeological dig that would have dated them to approximately 65 million years ago. So the dates in terms of some of these rather anomalous archaeological things do tend to confirm some of Van Flandern's hypothesis. So again, you know, if we plug that into this cosmic war idea, then clearly there were people of some sort of intelligence that had access to some technology that allowed them to do these things. So the idea of a cosmic war being fought at those particular time periods begins to take on a little more plausibility.
Yeah, and I also want to mention here that the book that you mentioned, Forbidden Archaeology, we've had Michael Cream on the program, so regular listeners know exactly what you're talking about here, you know.
Excellent.
So, okay, the question I guess arises is this war that you mentioned here that you're talking about. Oh, wait a minute, I want to back up a little bit more and just run this by you, because I remember the exploding planet hypothesis that you mentioned, Tom Van Flandern, and I guess that he also has measured basically the distance between all the planets and where now the asteroid belt is. Of course, is he basically came up with a mathematical equation, I think, on where, you know, planets actually should be located if you look at all the other planets,
right?
And there is one missing there, isn't that right?
Well, the law that you're talking to is actually an old astronomical law that was formulated by some German astronomers named Titius and Bode. And that law predicts, as you say, that a planet should exist in the orbit of the asteroid belt. And on that basis, they successfully predicted the orbit of Uranus and later discovered it. So the law was very successful in terms of 18th and 19th century astronomy. So when they discovered the first asteroid, they were in fact looking for a planet of some sort to confirm the law. The trouble was that what they discovered when they discovered the first asteroid was far too small to be a planet. And I should mention one other thing. A Canadian astronomer by the name of Ovenden modified Bode's law in, I think it was 1972, and in his modification of this law, not only could he predict the orbits of planets, but he could also predict their masses, and this becomes rather an important point in Van Flandern's idea, because the mass of the planet that he predicted that should have lied in the asteroid belt would have been of the approximate same mass as the planet Saturn. So Van Flandern was led to postulate that this now missing planet, interestingly enough, 19th century astronomers nicknamed it Krypton.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, that opens up a whole host of other connections.
Oh, yes,
you know,
oh, yes.
That have entered the modern iconography, so to speak. But this missing planet, Van Flandern, on the basis of the archaeological and geological evidence of asteroids, postulates was a water-bearing solid planet. In other words, it may possibly have been the home to intelligent life. And one of the things that I do in the book is, on that basis, then I speculate that, well, if that's the case, then that life is possibly going to be of much larger physiology. In other words, giants. So one of the things that I look for in the cosmic war is, as a bit of corroborating evidence of this, are there any giant remains? Because, of course, biblical and Sumerian traditions, as well as some Meso and South American traditions of Indian tribes over here, indicate that these giants came down, of course, from heaven and interbred with humanity and sired very large offspring.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this is one of the interesting little bits of archaeological anomaly that I explore in the book, because there are, in fact, some rather astonishing giant remains. Even St. Augustine of Hippo, believe it or not, talks about some of these things. So it's an interesting thing, because it's a bit of corroborating evidence, in other words, from a very strange quarter, that possibly this planet was home to intelligent life of that sort.
Wow. And the mythological aspect here is definitely something I want to explore.
Sure.
But I think that before we go there, I want to ask you a little bit about the kind of the opening phrase or opening meaning of your blurb, basically, that says rejecting the naturalist and materialist assumptions of catastrophism from Velikovsky to Alford. I have a basic idea. I have a few articles up on redicecreations.com about Velikovsky, Emmanuel Velikovsky's research. I don't know that much about Alford, Alan F. Alford's work. But do you want to elaborate a little bit further what you mean with this passage here?
Sure. One of the things that I do in the book is I use Alan Alford as kind of a foil or an exemplar of various schools of catastrophism, because at least in terms of the United States and Canada, he's a rather popular author over here, and he's certainly one of the more scholarly proponents of catastrophism. But basically, in Alford's view, when we examine Greek or Sumerian or Egyptian mythological texts, any time that we are referring to things chimerical, such as sons of God or anything of that sort, what he takes it to mean is a metaphor for a meteor that is debris from an exploding planet that crashes to Earth. So in other words, to kind of cut to the chase, the method that he uses in his examination of those texts is a reduction of almost every type of mythological reference to nothing but a metaphor of some sort or another for an exploding planet. And this, to me, ultimately fails, because in my examination of the mythological texts, he comes up with an interesting formula. He says that mountains, if you encounter references to mountains in these texts, that's a metaphor for planets. If you encounter a reference to oceans, that's a metaphor for space. If you encounter references to wars, that's a metaphor for planetary collisions.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I mean by naturalist assumptions. It's all a kind of a big mechanism, in his view, to explain catastrophism, and also, more importantly, to explain the rise of those mythologies. So
you don't quite agree with that idea?
No. The reason I don't is kind of twofold. On the one hand, there is the physics problem involved. If we have a large, massive body entering the solar system and colliding with a planet, it's going to have to do two things. The first thing is, it's going to have to leave a signature, a kind of a wobble, on the orbits of the planets. It's going to be rather analogous to floating a bunch of toy boats in a pond and then tossing a big rock into the pond. The boats are going to wobble and bob up and down on the pond.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And the second thing it's going to have to do is it's going to have to overcome what's called the Roche limit, which is kind of a natural gravitational defense barrier that exists around any massive body. Any massive body entering that limit is going to be subjected to massive tidal stresses, and as a result, it will usually break apart, much like the comet Shoemaker-Levy did prior to hitting Jupiter. So in other words, again, we're confronted with the problem of collision as a mechanism to explode a planet. You're going to have a massive body almost the same size as the planet that you're trying to blow up by that means.
Mm-hmm.
And the signatures just don't exist, in my opinion, for that to be a plausible explanation. The other thing that disturbs me about his particular approach is that when he turns to examine those texts that do refer to wars, he makes rather short shrift of them, because he comes up with this formula, as I indicated, of mountains equals planets equals gods, and then by implication that formula would say that wars equal collisions.
Mm-hmm.
But when you examine the texts themselves, there are a couple of other variables that he doesn't plug into his equation, and that really, if you examine them, means that his formula and therefore his examination of the texts collapses. Because in the text, particularly the Sumerian texts, one of the other things that are referred to when the term mountains is used are precisely acres or ziggurats or pyramids. So in other words, the texts themselves, in the context of references to this war, are referring to a artificial structure that is somehow involved in these wars. So in other words, the metaphor, the reductio to accidental collisions and natural causes breaks down at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, on that basis, his whole method is rather suspect. He wants to look at the text and see through everything, basically, in terms of the exploded planet hypothesis, and in the end he ends up really seeing nothing at all. The texts, to me, are very profound in that over and over again they insist, particularly the Sumerian texts, you just cannot read them without getting this impression that the people who composed them were rethinking, as they were doing so, of real events. One of the texts I cite at great length in the book is the so-called exploits of Ninurta from the Sumerian. And I cite it, incidentally, just so your listeners will know, I do not rely on any translation of Zechariah Sitchin.
Okay.
I rely on English translations of accepted academics.
Hmm.
And the reason for doing that is, of course, because Sitchin has had some criticism leveled at him for his translations.
Yeah.
I want simply to avoid that and point out that the texts themselves are really saying what they say.
Do you know if there are big differences between the academics that have translated and what Sitchin has come up with?
That's an excellent question.
Mm.
Actually, to be quite honest with you, when I started reading some of these translations, one of them in particular is by an Assyriologist at the University of Oxford. And in reading them, I have to be quite frank and tell you that I don't see all that big a distinction between Sitchin's translation and some of these academic things.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that rather interesting because, you know, to me this indicates that perhaps some that have leveled these criticisms against Sitchin are simply kicking against the goads.
Hmm.
They may be just creating a bit of controversy simply to discredit the man, but I didn't find all that big of a difference between them. But in any case, this exploits of Ninurta, I cite this at length, and the reason partially for doing that in the book is to show people that this is a very strange text if it's a mythological text, because what it consists of is rather like a very dry bureaucrat's report on the technology that was inventoried by the victors in this ancient war as they went in and took apart the technology of the vanquished party. It's rather like reading one of those American or British intelligence reports as they went inside of Nazi Germany at the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this goes on for pages and pages, Henrik. You know, it's it's very, very dry reading. But it's interesting because what they're doing is they're taking a technological inventory. And again, this rings very true because the Allies did precisely the same thing at the end of World War II. We wanted to find out what technology the enemy had, why in some areas they were so advanced, you know, what made all of this work. And in some cases we destroyed that technology. In other cases we simply carted it home and continued working on it.
Yeah.
This is exactly what happens in the Sumerian text.
Wow, absolutely fascinating.
Isn't it interesting?
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, so this is, and this is, I mean, again, there are so many tablets that has been found throughout the years and so forth, but how did you go about, so to speak, kind of, you know, picking the good ones, so to speak, or how, rather, my question is, how much information actually is out there and how much is available?
Well, in terms of translations, unfortunately, there's not, at least in this country, there's not a great deal available. I had to special order a lot of the stuff that I used. They were publications of the University of Oxford or Yale University and so on. They're not something that you would be able to go into a bookstore over here and pick up. I would imagine that many of these publications are much easier to acquire in Europe. Over here, you know, these things are just not the typical reading that a person's going to go into and read, so it has to be special ordered. But there is a lot available and a lot that has been translated, but, you know, you ask a very good question, because my impression is, just from the research I did, is that no more than maybe 5 to 10% of it has been translated. The rest of it is still, there's such an enormous volume of it that has yet to be translated and released in a public fashion that, you know, and that, in a certain sense, that does raise some eyebrows of suspicion, too. I recall that when America and Britain went into Iraq in this debacle that that continues to occur there.
Yeah, unfortunately.
That one of the first things that was done was that notice was served to the French and Germans, you know, to get your archaeological teams out of there. And in digging through the reports on the Baghdad Museum looting, I discovered that the Germans were keeping the catalog of the things that they had unearthed for Saddam Hussein. So, you know, even that catalog is as far as I've been able to trace thus far, is not really publicly available. So we don't know really what was taken during that looting, and to be frank with you, I'm a little suspicious that the supposed return of items that were looted, if they were in fact the same items. The whole affair just has a very, very bad ring to it, bad odor to it.
Could there be hints or suggestions among these artifacts on how to actually construct weaponry, and could there be things that, you know, today's more, I guess, esoteric / occult kind of researchers within the military are looking for?
Oh yes, definitely, I think so. One of the things I do in the Cosmic War is I explore in the Edfu Egyptian texts and in the Sumerian texts the motivations for that war. And one of the interesting things that comes out in those texts, Henrik, is that the motivation for the war is in part the possession of the technology to wage that war in the first place. The Sumerian texts in particular are full of references to what are called the Tablets of Destinies, and I know some of your listeners that are familiar with the works of Sitchin will recognize that term. These tablets, whatever they were, gave their possessors enormous, extraordinary power. And on each occasion of their theft, they're actually stolen, from what I can tell, either two or three different times in history.
Mm-hmm.
The first time by Tiamat, which occasions a war between her and her allies, and Marduk and his allies. And then there is a second theft by Anzu, or Zu, depending on which version of the text that you read, his name varies slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And that again leads to a war, and it's that second war, in fact, that is fought with Ninurta opposing him, that leads to this inventory of the stones, so to speak, that mm-hmm. were part of this technology, whatever it was.
Hmm.
So I examine the text very, very carefully in terms of what they might suggest in terms of modern physics that would be capable of doing the types of things that those texts describe. They describe manipulation of emotions. They describe manipulation of weather. They describe the destruction of entire celestial bodies, in other words, planets.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, this is a very sophisticated, very powerful technology. And I have a whole chapter in The Cosmic War devoted to a kind of a speculative reconstruction of what I think might have been in play in terms of the physics involved in those things.
Wow.
So yes, your question is an excellent one, and I think definitely people with an interest in esotericism or in science or anything of that sort might be able to look at these texts and come up with a similar sort of speculative reconstruction of what that technology may have been.
Hmm. I don't know if I understand things correctly about this tablet of or tablets of destiny, but I think I picked up on this that there is kind of an echo to what is known as the Spear of Destiny here, that those who actually had the Tables of Destiny were, considered to be invincible to some degree. Is that right?
Yes, that's quite so. That's quite so. One of the interesting things that some of these texts reveal is that when Anzu steals them again from Enlil, the Council of the Gods has a meeting in which they are trying to find somebody that will go to war against him and attempt to recover them. And it's rather humorous when you read this thing, because all the gods demur. They, well, you know, I can't do it because I'm busy that day, or, I can't do it because I've got other things to tend to, business affairs, or my weapons aren't strong enough. So this goes on for some time before they finally convince Ninurta, by kind of a subterfuge, actually, to do this. And then, again, once Ninurta has possession of them, he inventories them, he destroys some of them so that they can't ever be used again. Some of them can't be destroyed, and this is a very interesting aspect of the story, because then he decides that he's going to hide them. So, in other words, if we take these texts literally, as I think we must do,
mm-hmm.
then somewhere in that part of the world, something still may exist of that technology, which kind of puts an interesting spin to recent political events.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is very interesting because in one way we can look at it like this, that the U.S. now, in a way, or even potentially that the EU is joining up with the U.S. or whatever the kind of the coalition is here, but they are trying to prevent, Iran and even Syria to have access to nuclear weapons. So
right.
There's kind of an echo there, and yet the next level on this is, of course, that this has nothing to do with it. This is just a sham, just a play, so to speak, and they're really trying to get into this region for a number of reasons. But one of
right.
those might be what you just mentioned here, that they actually are again looking for something. You know.
Well, it's interesting that you mention that. Because here in the United States, there's a very famous researcher into the Kennedy assassination by the name of Jim Mars.
Oh, yes.
He was actually one of the people that consulted with Oliver Stone on his famous movie about the Kennedy assassination. And he and I were in contact a few months ago, shortly after I appeared on your show previously. And the whole reason for him consulting me was he wanted to run that theory by me. And just to kind of flesh it out a bit more, I think it's very peculiar that in the run-up to this fiasco in Iraq, the reports, I don't know what was said in the news in Europe, but over here, and particularly in the United States and Canada, I would imagine this to a certain similar extent in Great Britain, that the selling point, so to speak, for this military invasion was to prevent Saddam Hussein from acquiring weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
And then as events subsequently unfolded, it was discovered, well, he didn't have any, and if he did, you know, he got rid of them before we got there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've long suspected that maybe they were really talking about weapons of mass destruction of a very different and much more ancient sort. And once we say that, then we begin to look at that Baghdad Museum looting again with new eyes of suspicion, because it certainly appears that somebody was looking for something. And it doesn't appear that they were just concerned with acquiring some old Sumerian and Assyrian clay tablets. They are definitely looking for something.
That's right. Again, weapons of extraordinary power and sophistication. And I mean, in your Giza Death Star trilogy, you elaborate on this idea that the Giza complex was a kind of a super weapon, basically, I guess, you know.
Right.
And so, I mean, in your new book here, do you elaborate, kind of, have you found new evidence that there are potentially was more of these structures around? You mentioned that potentially this could even stretch to other planets, the Moon, the Mars, Saturn. Is there evidence for this in some way?
Well, yes, there is, and I'm glad you asked that, because I kind of want to let your listeners know what I'm doing in this book as opposed to what I do in the Giza Death Star series. In the Giza Death Star series, I'm primarily concerned with looking at a kind of a speculative physics reconstruction of the idea that these texts themselves suggest, namely that acres or ziggurats or pyramids are always associated with this technology of mass destruction. And in this book, I'm more concerned with fleshing out the scenario of the war itself. But in doing so, one of the things I discovered about these tablets of destinies is that they seem somehow, always in the text, to be associated with these acres or pyramids or mountains, as they're sometimes called.
Mm.
And this is a rather interesting thing to me, because it seems to kind of indicate that whatever these tablets of destinies were, and I think a fairly good idea of what they might have been, they were, to kind of coin an analogy, the software that made the hardware work.
Hmm.
So in other words, if we kind of couple it together with what I said in the Giza Death Star series, the Great Pyramid shows definite signs that there were things inside of it that are now missing, that were at some point in the distant past removed.
Yeah.
I refer specifically to those very strange slots that exist in the Grand Gallery, and to the niche in the Queen's Chamber and so on, that looks as if they were receptacles for something.
Yeah.
We don't know what. And, of course, Chris Dunn has hypothesized, and I think plausibly so, that they were some sort of resonator assemblies, at least in the Grand Gallery. So I think if we couple that with this whole idea of the Tablets of Destinies and then the inventory of the Stones of Power and so on that are talked about in the Exploits of Ninurta, that we see definite signs that these two technologies were coupled together in some fashion, and that, again, the texts seem to support the idea that something was removed at least from the Great Pyramid, if not from other pyramids or structures in the region. So, yes, the answer to your question is I go into this in much more detail in the new book and come up with some rather interesting conclusions as to what those Tablets of Destinies may have been.
Interesting, very interesting. So let's talk a little bit about potentially who, you know, could have been fighting this war, and even maybe who, you know, who the opposite sides here were, because you mentioned potentially here that humans were around at this point, either that they witnessed what was going on and actually wrote it down, or they were part of it. I mean, when you're reading the texts, do you find that there is mention of, you mentioned giants, of course, so this implies that these could be from you know, ET, extraterrestrial, of course. But do you have any more idea beyond that this is, you know, it's the Greys against the reptilians? I mean, does it ever become clear like that, you know?
Well, what pops out in the text, particularly the Sumerian text, is you have a clear, and I reproduce some of these genealogical tables in one of the later chapters of the book. You have a very clear division, it would appear, in the Sumerian pantheon. On the one side, the so-called good side, you would have people like Marduk, Enlil, to some extent Ninurta, Enki, and some of these gods and so on, mm-hmm. that are opposing in what looks to be a very protracted war, or at least a war that kind of erupts and then dies down and then re-erupts again. On the other side, you would have Tiamat, Kingu, Nergal, a very notorious character, incidentally the Babylonian god of Mars, and we'll get back to that in a moment. Anzu, and some of these others. And if you look at that in terms of the genealogical table, so to speak, of the Sumerian gods, it's two halves of essentially the same house. You know, my analogy is to think of it in terms of World War I,
mm-hmm.
Where, you know, you have the Hohenzollerns are related to the Sachsen-Coburgs, or the Windsors in Britain are related to the Habsburgs, or related to the Romanovs, and so on and so forth. So you have kind of that similar situation occurring where the houses of the Pantheon, like the houses of Europe, are all fighting each other. And this emerges very clearly. But the other thing that emerges, and let's go back to Nergal, the other thing that emerges is you can kind of trace this civilization to various combatants if you equate these people to their celestial bodies. Because Tiamat, of course, is very similar to the Hebrew word Tehom, which means the ancient primeval waters. So in other words, in Sitchin's reading, in Van Flandern's reading, in my reading, that would refer to Krypton, this exploded planet, a water-bearing large planet. And this would mean, then, that you would have that planet, Mars, which in Van Flandern's theory may have been a satellite of that planet, which would account for its very eccentric orbit once it's released by the explosion of that planet. And it would account for the sudden hemispheric-wide scouring and flooding that appears to have occurred on Mars very suddenly at some point. You would have those two celestial bodies. You would have also, in addition, if you factor in the Greeks and the wars of the Titans with this, you would factor in Saturn. And on the other side, you would have Earth, the moon system, and the sun itself. So in other words, this is something that you, if you follow the texts and their astrological and astronomical associations carefully, you can kind of even pin down to particular celestial bodies that are at war with each other. Now it's interesting that Saturn enters the picture here, because I don't know if you know, Richard Hoagland, the famous Face on Mars expert, fellow who's been examining all of these artifacts on the Moon and Mars very carefully, he has published a paper on his website, and I would urge your listeners to consult it. It's called A Moon with a View, and it's all about the moon Iapetus of Saturn. And you really have to see these pictures. I reproduce them in the book. of Iapetus. For one thing, this moon has straight edges. In other words, you can look at the horizon of this body, and instead of seeing a nice curved surface and lots of craters, what you're seeing are nice straight edge ruler type things that, you know, just don't exist in nature. The second thing you see is a very large straight line ridge running along the equator of the body, and in fact three parallel straight lines that rise above this thing. You see hexagonal craters all over the place. So in other words, you're seeing something that very likely is an artificial body. You know, it's rather stunning. And the pièce de résistance, I reproduce this picture in the book, is that if you look at Iapetus, a famous photo that the Cassini probe took and that NASA actually released, which surprises me no end, is that this straight line ridge with a huge hexagonally shaped crater above it, Hoagland puts this next to the Death Star from George Lucas's Star Wars film, and it doesn't really comment, he just puts it out there.
Yeah.
But the resemblance, you know, when I saw this, Henrik, my jaw literally hit the floor.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the resemblance is just too palpable. It's just too uncanny. And were it not for the fact that it's coming from someone like Hoagland and from a picture that NASA itself released, I'd be disinclined to believe it altogether.
Yeah.
But in terms of the cosmic war hypothesis, it fits very neatly into the picture because it explains all the references to Saturn and the involvement of that celestial body and its satellites in this war. So again, you know, if Iapetus is an artificial body and it has every appearance of being so, then again, we are dealing with an extraordinarily sophisticated, very, very ancient civilization.
And again, even the fact that, you know, the Death Star connects very much, you know, with your work, the Giza Star, you know, absolutely. It's fascinating. And I actually remember that there was another or several objects found that actually was dated. They were found here on Earth, and they actually looked just like Iapetus do, basically, with a not a ridge, maybe, but a small an inversion, basically, that the Death Star has, you know, this little channel, basically, that it goes around.
Oh, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay.
These were referred to in, I believe, Thompson and Cremo's book. They were discovered, these little balls were discovered in a geological layer in South Africa, if I recall correctly, that would date them to approximately 3.2 billion years ago. So in other words, we're talking something extremely ancient. But the odd thing is, as you've pointed out, that one of these balls, they're all so perfectly spherical that they are most likely the product of some sort of technology and machining. But one of them in particular has, oddly enough, three parallel ridges running along the equator of this little sphere, and above it there's this little pit or crater indented. And it's interesting, Hoagland himself reproduces that picture that Cremo and Thompson have in their book, and I reproduce it as well in The Cosmic War, and compares it to this satellite photo, the Cassini probe photo of Iapetus, and again, the resemblance is truly astonishing.
Yeah.
We are, once we've said that, we're no longer dealing with coincidences. There is some sort of relationship, there's some sort of civilization with a very advanced technology that existed long ago.
That's right. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating when these kind of connections are made. And again, they date this to 3 billion years old. But again, who knows how long, you know, Iapetus has been out there and around. So again, this could be some kind of retelling of the story. Someone has seen something and actually made small sculptures of the thing. You know, who knows?
Right. Well, even, you know, I even mentioned in The Cosmic War that this may be a kind of a child's toy model. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, but again, the real point is that the resemblance of these things, the occurrence of the mention of these particular celestial bodies in those texts that refer to a war, it all comes together because, of course, to fight a war of that nature, you're going to have some very sophisticated physics. You're going to have some very sophisticated technology. By the nature of the case, you're going to have to be an interplanetary civilization. And by the nature of the case, you're going to have to find some evidence of artificial structures, of the products of intelligence on those celestial bodies. And this is, in fact, what we find.
That's right. That's right, Joseph. We're actually approaching the end. For this first segment, I want to ask you if you have time for us and fill up for it. Do you want to continue in our subscriber section and talk a little
bit
more?
Sure. Give me just a few minutes to take a little break. I will be glad to do that.
No problem. Before we do that, though, I want to give you the opportunity to mention how people that are interested can get the book. Let me just say that the new book, Joseph P. Farrell's new book, is called The Cosmic War, Interplanetary Warfare, Modern Physics and Ancient Texts. And people that want to get a copy, how will they go about doing that?
Well, they can contact the publisher directly in the United States. That's Adventures Unlimited Press at 1-800-718-4514. The book is $18.95. And they can also go to their Amazon.com, www.amazon.com. If they prefer to contact the publisher directly online, they can do that at www.adventuresunlimitedpress. That's all one word, it's all lowercase, .com.
Excellent. Adventuresunlimitedpress.com. And Joseph's website is GizaDeathStar.com. And we're going to take a short break here, but and we'll continue to talk more about the Joseph's fascinating research in the subscriber section. But for this segment, thank you so much, Joseph.
Oh, thank you for having me back, Henrik. It's been fun.
You don't want to miss our extended interview with Joseph in the subscriber section. We'll get deeper into the Babylonian or Mesopotamian creation epic, tying this together with both the planets and the characters or gods. We'll also discuss more on the ancient technology used and who these, quote, gods might have been. A small group of renegade aliens? We'll talk more about the moon around Terra, why we haven't been back there. Possibility of alien threats and the idea of the Treaty of 2012 preventing us from exploring space. We'll tie all the knots together when we dive deeper into the Nazis and their interests in the occult, and how this relates to events taking place today, like the invasion of Iraq, why they're interested in going into Iran. Is there a bunch of occultists that have taken over from the paperclip scientists that are looking for something down there? So much more coming up. Subscribers, get ready for an excellent continuation of this interview. We'll be back on Sunday with Stuart Swerdlow. Don't miss it. My thanks to Fredrik and to you for listening. Check out the forum, sign up for our newsletter, and tell your friends about us. This is Henrik Palmgren. Until next time, take good care. They're gonna build a brand new planet. They're gonna leave for another world. They're gonna build a brand new planet.